winning sound of Network Sports.
And a very pleasant good evening to you, and welcome to another very special edition of Mason and Guests, heard on Voice of Barbados. You can call us at 441790. You can send a WhatsApp to 253-4679 or an email to cricketmason@yahoo.com. Mason and Guests is brought in association with our very good friends at ASFE White Rum, the best shot of the day.
ASFE White Rum. If anybody feel they could drink with me, let them come. Open your mouth, drink it up, or you can't qualify to sing this song. Tell me, bartender, ESA is the best shot of the day. Boy, pa 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 da 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 da, pa 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 da da. Say what you want, ESA is the best shot of the day. Is the best shot of the day.
All right. Lots of shots played in the BIM 10 competition. In fact, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But of course, the big news is that the World Cup, in terms of the finals, we played in Barbados. In fact, on September the 26th last year, we made that announcement on Mason and Guests. And on that occasion, Condé Riley was very much on the show, and president of Cricket West Indies. Of course, we're talking about our very good friend, Dr. Shallow, was also on that show as well, and he was didn't seem to be too quite sure, but we were very, very sure that it was going to be held very much in, of course, Barbados. So, we also heard today Stephen Leslie, the man in charge of marketing communications. He was talking about the tremendous benefits that are to be derived from hosting the game. So, without any further ado, I'm also going to bring in Philo Wallace, who's with us, and of course, Dr. Andrew Ford. But before we do that, gentlemen, I've got some breaking news for you. Listen to this. The Barbados squad has been selected for the 2024 Regional Four-Day Championship. Yes, I'm told it is going to be held in early February, and I want you, Philo Wallace, to make some notes. Make some notes. Craig Brathwaite, captain, Zachary McCaskey, Shane Mosley, Raymond Reefer, Kevin Wickham, Roshan Primus, Akeem Jordan, Kemar Roach, Zahirka McAllister, Shem Holder, Shaquille Cumberbatch. Now that's an interesting name, big fast ball. He's a groundsman at Kensington Oval. From what we've seen in the local competition, he is very much in there. Now I didn't call the name Shane Durridge because originally he was picked, but I'm told now, Philo, that Rivaldo Clark is the man who is going to be very much in there. And what's of interest, and listen to this, Philo, Shamar Brooks is the reserve. Now, how can you have what? He's about 36 years old now. In fact, let me give you the reserves, Philo. I've got the news. Demetrius Richards, Rivaldo Clark, Shamar Brooks, Jonathan Drakes, Kadeem Aline. Shamar Holder is a reserve. Now, that's interesting because I think if he's fit, he's got to be in there. Amari Goodridge, Zidane Clark, Gary Austin, Miguel Cummins, Kamari Boyce, Javed Leacock, Kemar Smith, and Ian Boyce. So, there you have it. A big, big list. Your reaction, Philo Wallace, Craig Brathwaite, captain, McCaskey, Mosley, Reefer, Wickham, Primus, Durridge, is not in there. Place taken by Clark, I'm told that is to be confirmed. Jordan Roach, McAllister, Warkan, Holder, and Cumberbatch. Philo Wallace, talk to me.
Philo? Good evening, Andrew. Good evening, Dr. Ford. Good evening to all your listeners and followers. Good evening to my friend, Sherlock Hart. My friend, Carlos, Boogie Bird, and Heaven. Andrew, Barbados selections are similar to Wesley's selection. They don't surprise me anymore. They were saying that there's the best possible squad available to Barbados. But my position with Shamar Brooks is that if you're not going to play him, don't put him as a reserve. I think he's good enough to play. And why would you put a man at 34 years old to be a reserve? But, you know, it is just a lot of mixed signals. I just want to wish the squad all the very best. When the campaign starts, Craig Bradford again is going to be at the helm. And I hope that we can push for victory. Obviously, I'm surprised too that Shamar Holder is a reserve. I think that Shamar Holder is of the quality that can make a Barbados 13-man squad. And it's quite, you know, obviously that's a surprise to me as well. And I hope he's not disheartened. He's done a lot of hard work in England. And I know he's good enough. And I know he's ready and he's willing. He's able to play for their cricket. I do hope that he gets an opportunity sooner rather than later, because he's on a course that I believe that he can regain selection into West Indies cricket team. But again, the Barbados selectors have picked their 13 or 14, and then a whole list of reserves maybe to play a practice game of somewhat. But obviously, I'm surprised that Shamar Brooks and Shamar Holder are both reserves in this Barbados squad. I don't know how they came up with it. But the selectors, Andrew, there's no surprises to me. I just want to say as well, Andrew, I want to offer the best wishes to the West Indies on the 19th squad. I came in late last night on a flight, all because the flight that they were on, some of the guys coming out of Jamaica, they came in late to get the connecting flight, and we arrived after 1 o'clock, and they told me that they were heading off this afternoon, well, this evening to London, and then on to South Africa. Cricket West Indies would not let us know, but they told me that. I wish them all the very best, and I hope that they can go there and do wonderful things and win that Under-19 World Cup.
Well, in fact, fellow Johnny Grave, the CEO, is on Zoom, so I don't know if you want to start with that. Johnny, Happy New Year to you, my friend.
Johnny was here, so he would say now.
Johnny, how are you? And of course, Chris Darren is also on the live. We're going to have a big focus on World Cup. Of course, it's on our doorsteps already. We really want to zero in very seriously on the whole question of the World Cup and other matters, of course, involving West Indies cricket. Good evening to you, Johnny. Nice to see you. How are you? Johnny?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you, Andrew. Good evening to you. Good evening to your listeners, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Right. Okay. Philo, you wanted to clear some of it, Johnny? Or not really?
I don't really want to clear him with Johnny Grimm. I just want to wish him a Happy New Year, all the best moving forward to 2024 with the T20 World Cup. Well, I said that I was that the under-19 squad has left Barbados today. Obviously, we want to wish them all the very best on that very tedious World Cup. It's going to be, you know, I think it's going to be very exciting for the young cricketers. We look at the various squads that are in there. I think the preparation that Cricket West Indies have put in the under-19s, I think they should do very, very good. If once they get down there and play to their full potential, a lot of those players have had the exposure as well now, so I think it's time that they can go there and produce. But I want to ask Johnny Grave, who is the management team in Australia, how things are progressing in Australia.
Yeah, you're right, Philo. Just going back to the under-19s, it's obviously they're making their way down to South Africa, having had that sort of adjustment to the T20, for the Under-19 World Cup with the move from Sri Lanka, who unfortunately weren't in position to host due to the challenges they faced there, and the move to South Africa. Obviously, we'd gone for that pre-tour to Sri Lanka to try and get ahead of the game and to give players time to acclimatise to those unique conditions ahead of the World Cup. But the World Cup's changed. It's exciting. They got their first warm-up game on Sunday, I think, against New Zealand, and then Nepal a couple of days later, and then we get into that tournament. But, yeah, certainly we wish them all the best. They've had a 12-month period of preparation under the leadership of Rohan Nurse, and hopefully with a few of them who have tasted the Under-19 World Cup before, they can do the region proud and get through to the latter stages and hopefully go all the way. So, we certainly wish them well. And it's good to see that the Under-19 women's squad is here already preparing for their World Cup next year. So they've been in Antigua now for 3 days in the start of their preparations for a 12-month campaign that will see them going to play their World Cup this time next year. So, it's an exciting time. And, yeah, I spoke to Andre Coley this morning, our time, ahead of their warm-up game that starts shortly in Adelaide. They've been in Adelaide since before the end of the year. So they arrived around the sort of 29th of December. So they've had a decent preparation period. The weather has been good and favourable to them, so they haven't lost any training. The management team for the test series is a couple of changes to that. One is that the batting coaching duties is going to be done by Jimmy Adams as one of the assistant coaches. Rayon Griffiths remains one of the assistants to Andre, and Sean Tate, who did the A-team tour along with Jimmy Adams when we went to South Africa, they've been retained for this series. So obviously Sean has a wealth of experience and knowledge of Australian conditions. He worked with Andre, Rayon and Jimmy during the A-team tour. So that's the technical coaches, and then team analyst, physio, S&C, team manager, media officer haven't changed. It's Avinesh, Dennis Byam as physio, Ronald Rogers, S&C, Roy Lewis, Dario Barthley, and then a massage therapist who's doing the entire tour, both the red ball and white ball of Dane Currency. So a 10-man management team for the test series, and then obviously slight changes for the white ball series that will follow these two test matches.
Mm. And when will there be a release on this? Was there a press release on this, Johnny?
We announced the test tour before Christmas, so yeah, it was.
I'm talking with the management team, Johnny.
I think the management team was included in the release, but if not, it's certainly no secret there. The whiteboard.
Well, I read the release. I read the release and didn't see it.
Okay. I can check our website as we.
Did you see it, Phil? Did you see it, Philo?
No, Andrew. I got the squad, but I didn't get the management team. And I'm always interested in the management team because obviously there's no the least letters not in Australia, but a very inexperienced squad. So a lot of responsibility is going to be on that management team. I know Ron Lewis has been there for a while. James is now the batting consultant. And Ashanti, who's continuing from South Africa. So a lot of responsibility are going to be on those guys. Really try to get these players to understand how Australia play and the conditions and what is required to do well in Australia, seeing that we don't have that experience, in particularly the lead selector. So maybe West Cricket West Indies didn't see a wise to have the lead selector there. So that's why I asked who's the management squad. There's going to be a big responsibility dealing with those players.
Interesting. Now, Johnny, let's turn our attention to the World Cup. Of course, the announcement came last week. We are happy that we were finally able to get the itinerary. And my first question to you, Johnny, we've been joined, of course, by Chris Darin, who's got so much experience in this area of organization. Are you on target in relation to your planning? That's my first question, Johnny Grave.
Yes, we are, Andrew. Yeah, it's obviously an honour and a privilege and a great opportunity and challenge to host a men's World Cup. And we are really excited now. The match schedule is a key landmark in terms of the planning. We are in dialogue with all the known now participating teams, obviously following the final qualifications at the back end of or the start of December, back end of November. We know all the participating teams and, we're now sort of looking forward to welcoming them into the region at various times and hopefully we'll have teams that want to come into the West Indies well before the tournament starts and the official warm-up period to play either our territorial board teams or to have acclimatisation camps. And, it's an exciting time as the countdown really now begins. And now the match schedule is known and is out there. And we're hoping, obviously, that thousands and thousands of fans will flock to not just the West Indies, but also the USA to watch this T20 World Cup.
Mm-hmm. So there are no concerns, basically, at this stage. You're on top of the top of the stack in relation to your planning. And at this stage, on January the 9th, there are no real concerns. Is that what you're telling me, Johnny?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we hosted the Under-19 Men's World Cup in this time 2 years ago, and that was 16 teams coming to the region. Probably more matches and more training schedules there. So cricket ops-wise, we're pretty experienced now, and most of the team that worked on that 2022 Under-19 World Cup have been retained into this one. Obviously, the Men's World Cup adds an added and good complication in the fact that we'll be selling tickets and hospitality, and hopefully having the party stands in action across all of our matches that we're hosting. But we've got unbelievable support from the host governments, and well supported by our territorial boards and local associations across the host countries. So again, we can, I think, rightly be confident that West Indies will again show that this is the best place to watch and play cricket in the world, and we'll do the region proud in hosting it.
All right, let's go to Chris Dare. Nice to see you. Happy New Year to you, Chris. Looking as young as ever. An Arsenal man. You're faltering a bit there, Chris, but these things happen. Of course, being beaten by Liverpool. It's a big thing for us in the Caribbean. Of course, Chris, to host the World Cup. What does it really mean to the people of the Caribbean to host a World Cup? Chris, good evening to you, sir.
Still muted, Chris.
Yeah, you're muted.
You hear me now?
Loud and clear. Very
important. Happy New Year to everybody, and especially to Johnny. He has a big task ahead. The two very important aspects to the World Cup. Obviously, one is being able to host the event in a manner that will satisfy all the host obligations, which is absolutely critical. So when Johnny, and I know he doesn't mean it this way, but when he compares it with the Under-19 World Cup, there's a massive difference in terms of the potential liability if you don't deliver on the host obligations. But I know he doesn't intend it in that way, and I'm sure he understands the significance and importance of that. But the second important part is having a team that participates well in it, because if you look at all global events, Football World Cups, Cricket World Cups, the spirit and the energy in a tournament can dissipate very quickly if your host team is well. So it's absolutely important that a lot of attention be placed on that aspect of it, making sure the West Indies is a competitive team, going as deep into the tournament as possible. I mean, you can imagine if the last Cricket World Cup in India, if India had been eliminated in the first round, how the tournament was structured prevented that. But if you recall in 2007, how the tournament was structured, India and Pakistan were eliminated in very early. So if it had been structured that way in India, you could have serious issues down the line just with getting your personnel motivated, volunteers motivated, governments motivated, because the West Indies doing well brings a lot of energy. So the one question I'd have for Johnny, and let me put it this way, Johnny, any sort of advice, critique, or whatever that takes place before the World Cup? It's like a cricket team. We talk about all the different strategies, people have different ideas, but once the umpire calls play, it's everybody in the Caribbean has to be on board, has to get fully behind you and the West Indies Cricket Board, or Cricket West Indies rather, and making sure this is a successful event for all of us. So that's when the bantering and the discussions and the opinions and subjective viewpoints needs to end, and everybody gets fully behind CWI in hosting this event. So the one thing I would say to you when I saw the kind of structure, two things, Johnny. One is the host venue agreement. What is the status of that for the individual countries and individual venues to be able to host? Because that is a critical document, so the people understand the do's and don'ts, the liabilities, things that they cannot do at the ground level. And secondly, it was interesting that you have taken on the role of both running both events. And I thought that you're either superhuman or you've gotten things so well organized since I've last involved in West Indies cricket that there you can sort of devolve the responsibilities to the individual territories almost solely.
Yeah, I think there's a few points to make. Firstly, with Andrew, can you please not mention Arsenal Football Club on this call? Chris and I know that it's the best football team in the world. And your listeners should embrace Arsenal Football Club. It's still time for them to jump on board and support the greatest team in the world, who have won the most FA Cup in the history of that competition. But back onto cricket. The host agreements with the governments and the stadium license agreements have been signed since May of last year. We moved in 2018 to a model where we host all of our cricket now under, the ICC model. So we get huge support from our governments for all bilateral cricket that we host in the region. And the MOU that we sign with the governments for hosting the recent England series or India in the summer is virtually identical to the MOU and the stadium license agreement that we would sign for the ICC World Cup. So we signed with the ICC well over 12 months ago, the host agreement with them. And then the individual MOUs for the six host countries and the stadium license agreements have all been executed since May, June of last year.
What about the US, Johnny? The US?
In the US, there's a new company that's been formed called T20 World Cup USA Inc. That's going to operate the US games. They've signed an agreement with Nassau County, who are the owners of the Eisenhower Park. Obviously, we know Broward County very, very well in terms of the stadium in Lauderhill. And obviously Major League Cricket own and operate Grand Prairie, which is kind of the newest, I guess, established cricket venue in Texas. So again, the situation there is they've got 16 of the 55 games that have been played across those three countries and territories. I guess two of the stadiums you would say are relatively low risk in the basis they've at least hosted either international or high-level cricket before in the case of Grand Prairie. Eisenhower Park in Long Island, New York, is definitely the most ambitious project I've ever seen in 24 years working in cricket, and very unlike the ICC historically to get so involved in a stadium. But then, you know, realistically, no one has really put forward a meaningful plan in the United States. And I think it's right to be ambitious and to have, you know, a 33,000 all-seater stadium in place in the New York tri-state area for this exciting World Cup, hosting probably, you know, the biggest game that's guaranteed to take place outside of the semis and finals, of which we don't know the teams, India-Pakistan. I think it's, you know, if we're going to really change the needle and the dial of cricket's interest in the US, I think it's right to be bold and ambitious and in playing in small stadiums and not playing in the major cities of the US would have probably mean that it was more tokenism than anything else. So I think playing eight matches in the New York tri-state area in a 34,000 modular stadium is a massive statement for the sport, and hopefully one that can be a fantastic legacy leading into, you know, what we now know will be cricket back into the Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 2028. So, and hopefully with Major League Cricket entering the second edition after this World Cup, and then hopefully continuing to progress in the years post this year, you know, we can start to look forward to cricket being a bigger sport in the US. And it's already a significant market for us and for many of the international boards, including the ICC. So it's not insignificant at the moment, but clearly it's the biggest sports market in the world, and one in which cricket is the second biggest and most popular sport needs to embrace.
Okay, just
what before, about your dual role? How challenging is that going to be?
Okay, Johnny, just hold your thought. We got to do a commercial break, but when we come back, that's a very important question. I also want to ask you, Chris Dearn, what you think about it. But of course, we'll certainly hear from Johnny when he comes back. Mason and Guest brought in association with our very good friends at ASFE White Rum, the best shot of the day.
ASFE White Rum. If anybody feel they could drink with me, let them come. Open your mouth, drink it up, or you can't qualify to sing this song. Tell me, bartender, ESA is the best shot of the day. Boy, pa 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 da 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 da, pa 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 da da. Say what you want, ESA is the best shot of the day. Is the best shot of the day.
CEO of Cricket West Indies and also the man in charge of the organizing committee, Johnny. Good question. Your reaction?
Yeah, look, when we knew fairly on that we were going to host this World Cup, thankfully, and we've got the Future Tours program. And what we were able to do is ensure that after the England tour, which obviously finished just before cricket for Christmas, and we're not hosting any men's or women's international cricket in the next 6 months. Therefore, operationally, at least outside of the women's regional tournament and the West Indies Championship that will take place in the next few months, really all of our operational focus will be on this T20 World Cup. It, as Chris rightly says, it's a huge moment for us as an organisation, and therefore as CEO, whether I'm involved indirectly or directly, it all falls on me anyway, and has certainly done in 2022 and 2018. So, yeah, in that respect, I think there's a number of us that are fully focused now on the World Cup. But obviously, you know, business still continues, and as Philo said earlier, we got the under-19s in South Africa, we got the under-19 girls in Antigua now, and the women's squad coming in. We're used to spinning multiple plates across every week of every year, and yeah, look, the World Cup is a massive opportunity and one in which we're all embracing. But it certainly doesn't mean that we're losing focus on Cricket West Indies' work. We're about to announce the 4-year strategic plan, and as I say, we've got important West Indies Championship cricket, regional cricket for the women, and lots of other things going on to ensure that we're busy and keeping the system moving forward. But yeah, it's not something that I'm unduly concerned about. And we've got a very experienced team under the leadership of Fawaz Bash as the tournament director. He was the tournament director for the under-19s. And while I accept what Chris is saying, it, operationally and logistically, it is similar in that respect, clearly in terms of travelling supporters and the commercial side and opportunity. And the profile of the event is different, but at least from a cricket ops perspective and logistics, it's a pretty similar event. So we got a very experienced team that you're used to hosting international cricket and have hosted the last two world events, 2018 and 2022. So one, I think we can be confident in that. You know, we'll do the region proud, as I said earlier. But it's going to be a very challenging event. And going back to Chris's other point, I think unfortunately, like 2007, this could be a World Cup that probably has more upsets than anyone beforehand, because there's 20 teams. There's some very good teams. It's T20 cricket, which is probably the format of the game that produces the most upsets. And, you know, the what we would historically have said are the minnows of the game, the emerging nations, the full members outside of the test playing nation, the islands, the Afghanistans and the like are competitive teams. And when it comes to T20 cricket, if you don't hit your straps from ball one, if you get the wrong side of the weather and DLS comes into play, you know, there will be upsets. And that, I think, makes it a very exciting tournament for fans.
No, let me come to you, Chris.
But also, Chris is right on the final point, which is, you know, I said, I think, well, last time on our show, we're also extremely focused on winning. And I take Chris's point around the importance of West Indies doing well. We saw that in 2018 with the women getting to the semi-finals. It's really important that on the back of two disappointing T20 World Cup campaigns and missing out on 2023, that the team do well. And obviously we've got some confidence coming out of the series in T20 format, where we beat South Africa in South Africa, we beat India and England at home more recently. But again, we've got to make sure that the team are well prepared and focused on the challenge and go and win that third title.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, the question is to you. Are you concerned about the fact that Johnny Graves is CEO of Cricket West Indies and CEO of the organizing committee? Are you concerned about that? That's the question for you.
Well, let's put it this way. When that was announced, it would raise questions for me. Johnny has answered it in terms of the organizational structure that is in place and so on. It would, from my perspective, one of the important elements in Western cricket is perception. The reality may be that he's fully on top of everything, on top of both. But the perception, if the West Indies doesn't do well, it's hard to get away from the perception. Hey, maybe he should have been focusing on the West Indies team and making sure that aspect did well, even if he was also doing the job of running the World Cup in reality, if not in name. So and that would be a concern that I would, you know, it's a risk that obviously CWI has decided to take, and we just have to hope it pays off and the West Indies at least get through the initial round, which they should. It looks like a fairly innocuous round. But,
really? Afghanistan?
Maybe Afghanistan, but we're playing at home. So I would think that we should be able to really truly rally the troops and get them through that. But I just thought that was something that, you know, would have caught my attention, having been before, and knowing the importance, the real strategic importance to a tournament of your home team doing well and perceive that it's been given every chance.
But Chris, something that you would recommend, though, where the CEO is also of Cricket West Indies is that something you would recommend?
If I was given the choice, no. But as I said, we're on the periphery. And that's the important thing. The people that are in charge know exactly the structure that they've set up on the periphery. And if I had the choice to set up an organization from scratch, probably no. But of course, you know, I haven't been involved in the day-to-day of Western cricket for a while. So, Johnny has a competent team, he says. I must tell you, Johnny, it makes me nervous every time I hear you compare the under-19, I'm running an under-19 tournament to the Cricket World Cup. Unless the host venue agreement conditions have totally changed. It's one thing to have a bad pitch in a bilateral series or an under-19 World Cup. You don't have a 200 million or 300 million people watching that match, that type of thing, and having the world's media pour scorn. Your team obviously has to raise their own game. I'm sure they're fully capable of it, but I don't think they should go into a Cricket World Cup thinking, hey, because I've run an under-19 Cricket World Cup, I can do the same things for a T20 World Cup, which, by the way, has grown incredibly leaps and bounds. If you just look at the ODI World Cup has grown in terms of viewership and commercial rights and so on. This T20 World Cup is going to be bigger than that in terms of viewership, just simply because of the sheer popularity of this format of the game. So I think it is something that, Johnny, as you rally your troops, make sure they know just because you've done an under-19, hey, this is a different beast, and it is continuing to grow, and those liabilities are continuing to grow. The other question I would have for Johnny is about Jamaica. Are you not seriously concerned about the fall away in Jamaica, your biggest market, your biggest domestic market? And what kind of plans are you going to put in place to turn around the interest of Jamaica in cricket?
Yeah, look, on the first point, and I'll just say it again, when I'm talking about the under-19s, I'm talking purely about the logistics, the movement of charter flights, the hotels, the welcoming of teams, the training schedules. From a cricket hosting perspective, the under-19 World Cup is very, very similar. I'm not saying that the demands of an under-19 team would be the same as a men's, because clearly that would be nonsense. But logistically, it is obviously the viewership of England that we've just successfully hosting was amazing viewing figures from around the world. India in the summer was. And most of the team have worked on multiple ICC events. I've been involved 24 years in cricket. My first ICC event was the 2004 Champions Trophy, which thankfully the West Indies won. So, look, we've got an experienced team, and the tournament director would be reporting into me irrespective of whether I had any involvement in this event anyway. The world game has moved away from setting up separate companies to run this event. So now And in recent history, whenever ICC men's events are hosted, they're hosted by the full member board, and the majority of the staff and the core staff and the leadership and senior management would all come from that full member. So the days of establishing separate companies and hosting under that model has sort of moved away, and that the ICC now rely on the full members to run those tournaments. And we've got a combination of, as I said, experienced CWI staff, so secondments from the Caribbean Premier League and others that will then ensure this event is as successful as we want to. In terms of, you know, any government and any territory that is you know, seemingly not supporting cricket in the way in which others are, is always a concern to me and to the organisation. We certainly will be taking cricket to Jamaica in the next couple of months, and certainly this year. You know, we continue to try and engage the Jamaica government in understanding the economic impact and the potential of this sport. We know they've got a very established tourism market, but the viewing figures and the platform that West Indies cricket gives them to promote Jamaica, not just for tourism but for economic development and to promote the brand of Jamaica through West Indies cricket, is vast. I think the sheer numbers involved now, I think there was an article the other day in the Observer here in Antigua that said that Alzari Joseph's net worth is now worth over $10 million. And if you think of some of those iconic Jamaican one-day players who have represented the West Indies, in the likes of Chris Gayle and Andre Russell and others, I think the business of cricket and the business of sport needs to be understood. The you know, I was looking at the numbers for hotels just for the 2 weeks of a World Cup. We're talking about, just for the teams alone and the TV crew, over 7,000 room nights for a 2 week period, over $2 million worth of hotel bookings alone. That's before any traveling fans or any caterers or vendors or taxi drivers or anyone has impacted. And certainly we need to continue to work with governments to understand the huge economic impact that cricket has. We are by far the biggest sport in the Caribbean, between Cricket West Indies and the CPL. You know, we're pumping in almost $100 million per annum into the economies of the West Indies. And when we ask for government support, it tends to be in tax waivers and ways in which they can make the hosting of cricket easier for us, in terms of providing access to the national stadiums, in terms of providing maybe some of the public services, police and transport and medical support. So we continue to, you know, work very positively with all the governments. We've got an open dialogue with the Jamaican government, and we want to continue to find a way in which they can get involved in some of the tours that we ask for more support than others. And historically, that's been England tours and India tours. And that's really just because of the economic impact that we know that with independence evidence is absolutely significant. And we have to share these tours around on an equitable basis. But when it comes to the high value tours, there are governments that will want to ensure that they can host them. And therefore, the best way for us to decide is to open it up to a transparent bid process and give every government fair and equal opportunity to host. And when governments choose not to, it wasn't just Jamaica that didn't want to bid for, or chose not to bid for the World Cup. Grenada didn't, St. Kitts didn't. In the end, unfortunately, Dominica had to pull out. But, you know, Grenada did decide to bid for the England tour. So I hope that Jamaica will engage us in tours and embrace the Caribbean Premier League in the future. But ultimately, that's a decision for them, and one that we will continue to liaise through the JCA with the government. And as I say, irrespective of that, we'll be taking cricket or professional cricket and first-class cricket to Sabina Park over the next couple of months.
Interesting.
It's not just the government though, Johnny. It's really I guess because that's where I live, I just get this feeling that cricket really is in the doldrums generally. So it's not just the government is really... and their lack of appetite is almost in tandem with the feelings that they're getting from the society in Jamaica. And I think that should be of concern to CWI, the largest domestic market. This is where you're getting half of your raw material or potential raw material from. whether it's from a fan base or whatever, from a domestic perspective. And just to see the sort of fall away of interest generally. Again, it's probably anecdotal, and maybe you have data that could tell us otherwise, but it just certainly feels that cricket is on a serious downslope in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
So certainly we hope that's not the case. And we've seen with local cricket, and when there's been events that take place, there's still huge interest in Jamaica in cricket, and certainly all of our social media figures, the viewing figures, suggest that there's still a big appetite, and clearly across our men's and women's team, including the youth teams and under-19s and academy, there's still strong representation from Jamaican cricketers. But look, it's certainly not something that we want to continue, which is why, now, outside of the England tour that we're hosting at the end of this year, we'll be taking international cricket across all three formats to Jamaica, I'm sure, between now and the end of the FTP that ends in the end of 2026, in which case, yeah, we hope when we bring international cricket back to Sabina Park that we do get that support from the Jamaican public. And as I say, we hope for a long-term solution to ensure that the Talawas can come back into CPL as well.
All right. Let's pause for business calls. Now, we got to do that when we come back. Dr. Ford, I know he's made several notes. And Raul Tony has joined us, noted journalist. Of course, they've got questions for you, Johnny, heading towards 7 o'clock. And it's now time for a commercial break. Mason and guests brought in association with the very good friends at ASFE. We're around the best shot of the day.
ESA feel like rum. If anybody feel they could drink with me, let them come. Open your mouth, drink it up, or you can't qualify to sing this song. Tell me, bartender, ESA is the best shot of the day. Boy, pa 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 da 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 da. Say what you want, ESA is the best shot of the day. Is the best shot of the day.
All right, Dr. Ford, Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy New Year to everyone on the panel and the listeners. Johnny, I have two questions, really. You were able to pass the most important hurdles and limiting factors of venues and then the fixtures. But my question is really about the game times and as to whether game times will be determined by the availability of lights or the prime time in the bigger viewership markets or other factors, and secondly, what are the provisions for any makeup games? Should games not be completed?
So in reverse order, there are reserve days for the both semi-finals and the finals, but there's no other reserve days for any of the other matches. Obviously, five overs per side constitutes a result in the T20 format under ICC regulations. So there's only reserve days for the semis and the final. In terms of the lights, all the venues have floodlights outside of the modular new stadium that's been built in Nassau County, New York. So there'll be a combination of morning games and evening games. Obviously, a strong preference from us to host games in the evening when it's more accessible for fans. And obviously, T20 cricket in our view is best played under lights at night, but obviously the match timings and the match schedule is ultimately determined by the ICC. So we're in the final discussions with them, and their main broadcaster Star Sports in terms of nailing down all the start times, but it'll be a combination of morning games and evening games.
But do you perceive that maybe the bigger source markets can have an effect on when games should start? If they're bringing in more revenue, that you know, the viewers may want to see their games in prime time, let's say the Indian market or maybe some of the lesser markets, or you think it's just going to be purely logistical? Even though
it will be dominated by the Indian broadcast market as cricket is, so there will be a strong call for as many games as possible in Indian prime time, which for us on Eastern time will be 10:30 a.m. in the morning, and obviously, you know, we'll be pushing to make sure there's a balance between morning games and evening games, and the evening games will probably be around the 7:30, 8:30 time, which will be morning time in India.
Do you think that maybe games that I mean, the games that India might play would be more in the day, because that's when their viewership can see their team more comfortably. I'm asking the question naively because I don't really know the answer.
I think it would be fair to say that all India matches will be in the morning, prime time, both for their group games, and if they make it through, which we expect them to, for the Super 8s, they'll all be playing in the morning. I think by default, you know, the vast majority of West Indies games will be played at night under lights when our fans can go. For morning matches in the Caribbean, particularly during the week in June, coming to the end of the school term, you know, it is an opportunity for us to get the next generation of cricket fans into the grounds to experience World Cup cricket, and we'll have a comprehensive primary school and secondary schools program to get free access for West Indies school children to attend matches. But clearly we want to strike the balance between day games and night games, and I'd expect when the announcement is made on the match start times, there will probably be an equal mix really of morning games and evening games.
Well, there'll be some movement of teams, and after the group stage, then we'll have I think it's the Super 8s, and teams will have to move to locations based on where their matches would be. Do you see that as a pivotal time? Let's say the group stage finishing, some finishing the 17th, some finishing the 16th, and then some having a game maybe 2 days later. Do you see it as a difficulty transporting whichever team it may be to that location? Is that going to be a really crunch time for the tournament?
Yeah, it is. It's a big moment. Once you finish the group stages leading into the Super 8s, it's a key moment. There's only one day, as you acknowledge, between the final group game and the first Super 8 game. One of the reasons that we've therefore predetermined the Super 8 team. So we know, for example, if India qualify, which we expect them to, where they'll be playing their Super 8 games. And obviously, if they didn't qualify, then the third, whoever the qualifier is from their group, would replace them in that qualifying slot. So with the Super 8's seedings effectively being predetermined, it allows logistically us to know in advance, hopefully, at least 80 or 90% of where those teams will be flying at the end of their group stages for the Super 8s, knowing that even if they finish second in the group, for example, India will be A1. If England finish second in their group, they'll still be qualifying for the Super 8s in that B1 position or whatever their group number is. So it's something that the ICC have done before. And again, it just allows, it's a very short window for this tournament from the IPL finishing to the English summer or the Northern Hemisphere bilateral summer starting. So again, we're not afforded with a huge amount of time between the group stages and the Super 8s, nor the Super 8s in the semi-finals and the finals. But again, T20 cricket players are used to playing, you know, back-to-back games and having lots of play rest, or play travel play. So it's something that professional players have just got used to, really, in the T20 format.
Well, give us an idea of the fallback plan. You know, you have seedings, you have expectations, but as we've seen with most of these ICC tournaments, there's always a team that throws the upset, or maybe two teams, and they're in a place that you didn't expect them to be in, and they make a Super 8 you didn't expect them to make. Well, what's the fallback? I know we have our regional carriers. Is there a dedicated charter or some plane that can move around and do things just in case, or are we going to be dependent on the regional carriers alone?
Now, all of the logistics of the tournaments, all the staff, all the players, match officials, TV crew will all move on private charters. We'll have a big logistics team, as you can imagine. The requirements for this event, with, I think, at peak, 5 broadcast crews coming into the tournament, it's a huge operation in that respect. And yeah, we'll be. And that's not to say that private charters without their challenges, because they are, and we know that firsthand. So. But clearly, from a risk perspective, private charters is the least risk approach, and certainly one that will be operating throughout the tournament.
Private regional or international?
A combination of, so we'll be using private charters with both Caribbean Airlines and probably to a certain extent as well Inter-Caribbean at times. We'll also need international charters, just because the volume of the volume of matches that we'll have.
John, you said Inter-Caribbean?
Yeah, so for the Cup, the last England tour, there was a number of tour groups and charters that were done by Inter-Caribbean as well.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
I think one of our guests hasn't had a chance to ask a question.
Yeah, we're all Tony. Yeah.
Actually, I just want to
continue.
I think Dr. Ford touched. Well, good evening, gentlemen. I think Dr. Ford would have touched on it. Interregional travel is a huge bugbear for sport in the region in general. How much planning during the planning stages of for the World Cup did you guys had any commitment or meetings with Inter-Caribbean, Caribbean Airlines? Because I know you did mention that, you know, for the logistics crew, camera, players, teams, and so forth. But from a fan perspective, have there been any commitment to add additional flights based on vamped up in ticket sales or anything of the sort from matches within the region? Particularly, you have a semifinal in Trinidad, a semifinal in Guyana, and then a final in Barbados as well. Have there been any direct communication with the two major airlines that traverse around the region about having sustainable flights or additional flights during the period for the World Cup?
Yeah, absolutely, there have been. I mean, we've been talking to Caribbean Airlines and Inter-Caribbean now since probably June of last year. Obviously, they were eagerly awaiting the confirmed match schedule to really then start to get into that detailed planning and make flights available for fans. And they're expanding their networks anyway in terms of their itineraries and the number of planes. And yeah, we certainly hope that the schedule will be friendly to fans in that respect. And certainly the assurances we've had from senior management of both Caribbean Airlines and Inter-Caribbean is that they're really excited by us hosting the World Cup. They want to embrace it as much as they possibly can. And they want to do everything possible to make it as easy for West Indians to travel around and enjoy the World Cup and rally behind the team. So hopefully that's encouraging. And those conversations continue. And clearly also we're hoping that the other international carriers that come in directly into the West Indies will continue and it'll almost extend the tourism season. So where they would normally be looking to relocate planes in June and July to other destinations as we come out of peak tourism season, we're looking obviously for that to be extended, as well as the American networks to continue to connect, particularly Miami and New York, where there will be matches and fans coming to that they can hop into Miami and New York and then continue to enjoy the World Cup in the Caribbean through those international carriers.
With regards to marketing the event within the US, I know that there's always some major sporting activity happening within the US. How much marketing or how much has the Cricket West Indies and the organizers for the T20 World Cup this year have put in place emphasis into promoting the World Cup in the USA? I know it's coming around on the heels of just as we're heading into the Olympics as well too. Then you have the NBA season that playoffs would be about to start. So you're having, you know, without being drowned out in terms of hearing about the World Cup on major television across the US, how much emphasis has CWI and the organizers have placed into promoting and marketing the World Cup and cricket rather in the US?
Yeah, look, there's a big marketing budget for this event. Obviously it's not just about the US, there's more matches in the West Indies, and we're obviously very focused on making sure that, you know, we can market and promote the World Cup here in the Caribbean. But yes, in terms of the US, there's a big marketing budget. There will obviously be a big PR campaign as well, and the trophy tour and everything else that goes with the World Cup. The venue itself, I think, in New York will attract a lot of attention, whilst modular stadiums are being used to host, you know, the Miami Grand Prix, the Las Vegas Grand Prix, whilst stadiums are converted from baseball and to soccer, from American football to baseball, etc. And drop-in wickets are pretty well used and commonplace now in Australia and New Zealand. So none of the technology is new, but it's a complete first for cricket to have a modular stadium of this size using all of that combined technology. So that in itself, I think, will create some big PR noise in the US, as well as the fact that, as you say, I think the US or the message around the LA Games had a big effect. I was in America when that announcement was made, and it had a big effect amongst sports fans and the sports market. I think one of the challenges we've got is the media networks in the US. The World Cup will not be on one of the major networks of US, so that is something that we've got to address as a sport. But there'll be a huge percentage of that marketing budget in the US will be driven by digital, and we expect most of the tickets to be sold online in the US, and clearly the a data driven marketing plan using digital advertising will be a big part of the US strategy and approach.
Interesting. All right, we're going to pause for business calls. When we come back, we're going to get some reaction, of course, from Kasdeer, and I want to ask him if he's got any concerns at all. I asked Johnny that, and Johnny said that everything is looking pretty good. Mason and guests brought in association with the very good friends at ASFE White Rum, the best shot of the day.
ASFE White Rum. If anybody feel they could drink with me, let them come. Open your mouth, drink it up, or you can't qualify to sing this song. Tell me, bartender, ESA is the best shot of the day. Boy, pa 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 da 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 da, pa 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 da da. Say what you want, ESA is the best shot of the day. Is the best shot of the day.
But it's now 12 minutes past 07 o'clock. Of course, if there are any other questions, not only World Cup, any other questions that you have got, Raul, or of course Dr. Ford, about anything in relation to West Indies cricket, then you can certainly answer. Well, you can ask Johnny and hope to get some answers. Yes.
Oh, I hope I'm not too late to say Happy New Year to Philo and Dr. Ford, the two that I really know well, and the others as well. Philo, Happy New Year to you, man.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, Ken. I have a question for Johnny.
Yes.
Johnny, in 2007, when the Caribbean hosted the World Cup, there was sunset legislation from movement of people from the region when it comes to the cricket. Obviously, you've incorporated the USA. Most Caribbean people, if not all Caribbean nationals, need to get a visa to get into America. So there's their World Cup matches in America that some Caribbean people will want to watch. Do they have to have that visa to get into America?
Yeah, you will. The US immigration for this event won't change. Obviously, the West Indies themselves are playing exclusively in the West Indies, as you would expect. And we've been in discussion with CARICOM heads again since June around trying to facilitate a movement within the CARICOM countries that are hosting it. So our six host countries, that mean once you've entered the region that you don't have to have a visa to obviously move within the tournament within the West Indies. So we expect the and are talking to CARICOM and impacts around that, and hopefully it'll be something that we can confirm well ahead of the tournament, that at least from a movement within the West Indies, it will be made as easy as possible for our international traveling fans.
Chris, your reaction?
Well, Andrew, I know, like when you use the word concern, because the reality when you're hosting an event of this nature, there are going to be lots of issues that you have to deal with. So it's not a matter of being concerned about them. You recognize that there are issues that you have to deal with, and you put plans in place. The question about the single domestic space, though, I thought that worked really well in 2007, because it really helped to facilitate the movement between countries, you know, so players would, you know, leave their bags outside of the room, and the next time they see their bag is in the hotel room in the next country, almost as if they were traveling in the same country. They didn't go through immigrations and customs and fans, you know, there were special lines set up. So I'm wondering, one, is that going to be set up for this World Cup? And of course, the other important aspect of the sunset legislation was the whole question of protection of rights, various sponsorship rights, the whole, you know, I feel, Johnny, you owe me a drink, because I broke the back and took all the brunt and into educating the market on terms like ambush marketing and building new stadiums for you, that so you don't have to worry about these issues anymore. But the Sunset legislation was helped to achieve that, helped to achieve a commonality across the Caribbean countries, at least, in terms of how the approach was to ambush marketing, protecting sponsors' rights, and so on. And that was pretty successful in the sense that there were we didn't have any commercial claims on the event. That's one on a single domestic space. And secondly, on the domestic TV rights, what is the plan to disseminate the television side on the domestic side? Sure, I know you're going to make a lot of money on the international side as part of it, but what is the ICC how is the ICC going about the domestic side? Because it, again, I think that's an opportunity to help regrowth, the rebirth of the sport in the Caribbean. Not just keeping it, you know, if there's some way you could get packages, some matches on free-to-air broadcast, you know, as almost like a promotional aspect to the event.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're certainly trying to increase the reach of West Indies cricket. We were live on CNC3 in Trinidad and Tobago as a trial on terrestrial TV for all of our recent international engagements against India and England, and again, very strong viewing figures there. For the ICC, the media rights are all owned exclusively by ICC, and they announced probably about a year ago that they would continue with ESPN Caribbean as their exclusive broadcast partner in the region. So this event in the West Indies will be live and exclusive on ESPN Caribbean, as the under 19 boys will be in the next few weeks. So again, I don't anticipate, and albeit I wouldn't completely rule it out, but it's unlikely that this event will be on terrestrial TV in the West Indies.
And the legislation in terms of protection of rights and ambush marketing, single domestic space, anything going to be happening there?
Yeah, as I said, earlier, we've been in discussions with CARICOM about that freedom of movement within the West Indies, replicating what happened in 2007. I think, thankfully, the ICC have slightly moved away from their slightly draconian position that they had in 2004 when I hosted the Champions Trophy, where they were going to the extent of making us put masking tape over TV branding and toilet branding and all sorts of stuff. So now ambush marketing isn't as quite as a hotter topic as it has been previously. And whilst there is exclusive protection for the very top tiers of their sponsors at global level, ambush marketing hasn't been the threat it was beforehand. And the sort of the ambush effects of Coke and Pepsi and others beating themselves up over international sporting events has died down a bit. So hopefully we'll get the balance more around how we had 2018. So yes, we will be respectful and comply as much as we have to with ICC regulations, but at the same time we want our West Indies fans to come into the grounds and watch the cricket as in the way that they're used to and the way they want to. So, you know, flags, drums, musical instruments, coolers, etc. will all hopefully be allowed in. And we'll get round those challenges as we did in 2018, so that West Indian fans can watch the cricket in the way that they're used to and accustomed to. Because ultimately, that's what the international travelling fan wants. They want to come to enjoy the West Indies in stadiums full of West Indians fans being noisy and loud and enjoying their cricket. And we need to create that unique atmosphere in our stadiums. And certainly, we want to embrace our fans and give them the opportunity to watch the cricket in the way that in which they're used to.
Okay,
I know that Andrew doesn't want to ask.
Yes,
want to.
Go ahead, doctor.
But ahead. I know that Andrew, you're big on radio. So the real question is radio going to be only based on what the international countries are doing, or is there going to be some West Indian flavor to the radio coverage, or you know what's happening with radio? Even though we talk a lot about TV.
Yeah, the radio rights, so again, the ICC control all the media rights for this. In the last cycle, they did a global 8-year deal with a company for all the radio rights for their ICC events. They're still in negotiations on radio rights for the entire next cycle of men's events. So yeah, it's something that we're certainly we're hopeful that the coverage will be accessible on radio, and again, as always, we'll be pushing for there to be some local flavour to the commentary, but something that's not in our control. Those rights sit very clearly with the ICC as the tournament owners.
Have you taken in terms of ticket prices, how much consideration were given in terms of the disparity of the ticket prices in the US and ticket prices in the in the different territories within the Caribbean? Like, an average price, what would that look like though for cricket fans?
Yeah, we're still sort of talking about the ticket pricing with ICC. We're hopefully in the final few hurdles of getting that agreed. There will be a big disparity, I can tell you now, between the ticket prices in the US versus the Caribbean. Our focus is very much on making sure that the matches in the West Indies are accessible to fans. We're not being swayed at all or being influenced by the US market in the ticket pricing. The ticket pricing that we want in the Caribbean will be as low as $5 per match for some of the games, because we want the stands to be full, and we want people to come to the games and enjoy the cricket. And we certainly don't want to price out the fans. You know, the latter stages, Super 8s, and certain stands within the grounds will be priced at higher levels along with the final. But we still want to make as many of the tickets as possible accessible to fans in the West Indies.
When do you think we'll have some ideas to those ticket prices, Johnny? When do you think we will know? Because people have to prepare.
Yeah, we're looking on going on sale with tickets, probably through a ballot, to make it as fair and equitable as possible so that everyone has an equal opportunity to purchase tickets to the event. So we expect the ballot to open later this month. Normally the ballot will run for 5 to 7 days and then will close. You'll then find out whether you're successful in the ticket ballot or not, and then have another window of 5 to 7 days to complete your purchases. And then after that point, we will open up to general admission. With all ICC events, as you can imagine, there's a decent number of tickets retained by ICC for their commercial obligations and for the teams that may or may not be taken up in full. And so we would expect there to be, and we will certainly communicate and encourage fans to register so that when additional tickets are made available for matches, that they know firsthand through emails and through messages, so that they can be first in line to buy. But we're certainly expecting this World Cup for the vast majority of sales to be online, albeit particularly in the West Indies. If there are tickets available on the day, there will be box offices in which fans can go and purchase tickets as well.
The ticket prices, Johnny, the ticket prices resonate during the discussions with the various governments around the region in terms of their support and in terms of having, you know, accessibility to ensuring that their people have access to attending these matches. And any economical guarantees were given to governments within the region for Cricket World Cup, for the T20 World Cup, I should say, because having covered the 2007 World Cup and the 2010 T20 World Cup, following which there were some complaints from various governments about the economic downfall that were promised by the ICC and CWI at the time. They didn't get a chance to see that turnover from those matches. How did those discussions went with governments that are hosting matches for the T20 World Cup, and how much did the ticket prices for these matches actually were incorporated in those discussions?
I think we've been aligned with the governments for a while now in terms of making sure that we don't outprice fans. We make tickets available at the lowest possible price and have different areas of the venues that have different price points to try and make everyone to have an affordable level. So from grounds and mounds, where the tickets are fairly low in terms of single-digit dollars, up to obviously the best seats in the house, which tend to be more expensive. But yes, I think Cricket West Indies and the governments are completely aligned in terms of making the matches accessible and affordable. No guarantees were given in that respect, but again, you know, we're we're long-term partners with the governments, and we successfully host cricket most months of the year. So it's something that we're constantly talking to the governments around. So I don't think, yes, West Indies cricket retain all the ticket revenue, but you know, we're not looking to have short-term gains in this World Cup. We're looking for long-term legacies to this World Cup, and we want to make sure that the grounds are full. So it's a balancing act. The latter rounds, final, etc., will be at higher price points, but certainly the early games and the vast majority of games will be very competitively priced when you compare it to West Indies internationals and Caribbean Premier League prices. So I don't think fans will be shocked in terms of what we're coming out for, and certainly we're not looking to put a big inflationary figure on the World Cup. We're looking to get the tickets into the hands of our fans at the lowest possible price.
4341790. We've got someone in Jamaica. Hello, good evening. Good to hear Johnny Grave talk about cricket coming back to Jamaica. Can he be more specific, Johnny?
No. Well, we're certainly making recommendation, and you can imagine the complications of trying to schedule the West Indies Championship in and around all the work that is happening, particularly in terms of those match playing surfaces. We're relaying a huge amount of squares and extending squares, wickets, and we don't want to compromise on the World Cup. So, I can, subject to board approval, I could guarantee that Sabina Park would be hosting 4-day West Indies Championship cricket over the next few months.
And the 4-day championship starts in February. So can we come to the conclusion that Jamaica will be hosting regional cricket come February?
Well, the first class season is February to April. So yeah, they'll be hosting several matches in that period.
Okay, so Jamaica then, Chris, you will be able to go to Sabina Park, according to what Johnny Grave is saying, and watch some first-class cricket. Maybe Barbados will be up against Jamaica at Sabina. So you're getting some first-class cricket. You're confirming that, right, Johnny? That should make primetime sports in Jamaica tomorrow.
Subject to board approval, I'm confirming that. And obviously, we need to get the confirmation from Sabina Park and the JCA, which we're in the process of doing, that the Sabina will be ready to host, as some fans would call it, proper cricket. I'm not sure that's necessarily what Chris was referring to in terms of engaging.
Let's put it this way, Johnny. I think let us use it as a test case and see how many people play those games. To understand the malaise that is taking place in Jamaica, I believe, over cricket. Again, this is purely anecdotal, and I, you know, would bow to the data. If somebody can show me data of apart from, you know, because I always use live match attendance as a data point as well. You know, it's just a microcosm of general interest. So, you know, last year I asked 20 people, Johnny, who won the regional one-day tournament in Jamaica. Just random people, both, you know, different sectors, and nobody knew.
Oh, really?
And, you know, Jamaica won.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? Oh, my golly. 4417790, give us a call. If there are any other things you want to ask about, of course, we've been going on the World Cup for just over an hour. But if there are any other questions that you have, Raul Tony, of course, Dr. Ford, you can ask Johnny. Johnny, I've got a question for you in relation to Courtney Brown and Eldeen Baptiste. What's the situation as far as these gentlemen are concerned? Have they been paid? Because I'm hearing that they may be going back to court. Is that true, Johnny?
No, not to my knowledge. We agreed a settlement figure with them just prior to going to court earlier last year, and they were paid in full within short order after that. That decision or agreement was struck. So, that's the situation as far as
Can you repeat what you just said, Johnny? Are you saying to me that Brown and Baptiste have been fully paid? I've got information to the contrary.
That Johnny? Is the information that I have here.
Is it information that you have? So why is Mr. West...
As far as I'm concerned, they've been paid. They've been paid in full.
So, well, that's not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that they've not been paid in full, and as a result, they're going back to the Industrial Court of Antigua. You haven't heard about that?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Mm. Okay. Johnny, are you sure you want to stay with that?
I am 1,000% sure I want to stay with that, Andrew. I don't know what else I can say. I spoke to Mr. Loy West and L. Dean Baptiste when I bumped into them at the Yellow Jacket event.
But Johnny, I'm giving you an opportunity to retract.
I don't need to retract, Andrew.
So do you want?
We paid them.
So do you want me to play a clip that will not support what you're saying?
I'm not saying that people would disagree with me. I'm telling you that as far as I am concerned, and the information that we agreed, that was executed in legally binding documents, that we paid those gentlemen what was agreed in two separate payments, one back in 2019 and one in 2023, and that they were paid well before, I would say, August of last year. I can't remember the exact dates, but as far as I am concerned, and Chris West Indies are therefore concerned, whatever the settlement figure was across two payments, one in 2019 and one last year, they were paid in full. And if they disagree and they wish to take us to court, then that is their right to do so, and the legal system is there to support anyone that believes that they've been the wrong side of what is right. But as far as we're concerned, both of those individuals were paid according to the agreements that we agreed with them through their legal representatives. I can't say any more than that. If they dispute that, they can quite rightly take it up with the court, and we'll go and have a discussion. But luckily our situations, as you know, from a legal perspective, are significantly less than they have been historically, and you know, we're not looking to be in dispute with anyone, and where we do find that we need to make agreements, we try and do that in a fair and reasonable and respectful manner, which is what we've tried to do over the last few years. And as I said, we don't have many or any real outstanding legal situations, thankfully, and not one that we're looking to add to that list, much I'm sure to the disappointment for some legal representatives in the Caribbean.
All right. Philo?
Johnny, I want to ask a question in relation to Australia. The second test match is a pink ball game, isn't it? Is it? That's correct?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a day-night game of the Gabba, in Brisbane.
The Cricket West Indies is trying to get a practice match using a pink ball while there, because some of our players might have not used a player with a pink ball.
Yeah, and even if we used to play, I think, one or two rounds of the West Indies Championship on a pink ball basis. But again, that was a Duke's pink ball rather than a Kookaburra one. So, we would have been training with it, but when we scheduled didn't allow, we were given the opportunity, if we wanted to play this four-day game under a pink ball status. But the decision was made that we wanted to play that with a red ball, and that's what we're doing. So we're playing this current 3-day game at the Karen Rorton Oval in Adelaide under a Red Bull day game basis. And unfortunately, there isn't the time to get a second warm-up game. Obviously, when we toured last year, we had two warm-up matches, which was great. We've got one this year. And it's going to be it's always interesting to see how the pink ball performs under lights. And, you know, it's a bit of a lottery in terms of when you're batting and when you're bowling, when it's twilight and when the lights really come into effect. And I sincerely hope we get the right side of that for once, and we can have those favourable conditions with the ball and put the Australians under pressure with a Kookaburra pink ball, which is at times, quite lively.
Another question, Donny, Jadon Seale. What is the situation with him?
Yeah, it's obviously disappointing for him. Injured last year with his knee, and then that shoulder injury that he picked up on the 18 tour. The operation was successful. He's in rehab. He started bowling and been training with the Red Force. We had hoped, and obviously for obvious reasons, that we'd hoped that he would be declared match fit and ready for the Australian series, but it's come too quickly for him. And therefore, we're hoping that he'll prove his fitness and form in the West Indies Championship as early as possible. Unfortunately, possibly not for the first round or two, but obviously we're hoping for the latter parts. And then, you know, we're also hoping that he'll get an opportunity like he did last year, but he wasn't really able to take it up in county cricket, so that when it comes to that England series in the summer, which immediately follows the T20 World Cup that we're hosting, that Jadon will be fully fit, raring to go, and not just played some decent Red Bull cricket in the Caribbean. He's also played some English cricket, Red Bull cricket, so that he's, you know, in really good stead in terms of adjusting to the demands of English cricket conditions. And yeah, we can retain that Richards Botham trophy when it comes to playing the three test matches that we've got in England in the summer.
All right, 4341790, give us a call. Dr. Ford, you've been very quiet. Any questions for your good friend, Johnny Grave or Chris Darren?
Well, I mean, for Johnny, my real question is, what is your vision of a successful World Cup for the region? Not so much as it relates to the possibility of us winning, but I mean, from a logistical standpoint and otherwise, that can, you know, make you feel satisfied with the efforts that you intend to put in.
I know we can't control it per se, but I would say, yeah, West Indies winning is right up there in terms of success, in terms of really creating a legacy, in terms of really engaging the fans. West Indies winning a third title would be you know, would be the ultimate, and that's what we're very, very focused on. It, yes, we're hosting it, and yes, we need to make sure that we can welcome the world and welcome thousands and thousands of fans to boost the coffers of the region. But you know, very clearly, we want the West Indies team to be successful. As I said earlier, we had two very disappointing campaigns in 21 and 22 in the T20 format, and we want to do the region proud. And the best way to do the region proud is to not just to host you know, a very successful and smooth operation and well attended matches, but you know, for the West Indies to win, and the West Indies to win at home in front of their home crowd would be the ultimate for any home board, is to host a men's event or women's event and win it. And yeah, that's really what we're focused on. We want to have a very successful campaign on the field, as well as obviously a smooth one off the field for all the teams to come and enjoy playing in the West Indies. But when it comes to playing against us, we want them to have a miserable time.
Chris, as a guy being on the inside previously and now being on the outside looking in, what's your biggest concern just as a casual observer this time around compared to the last time? You're muted.
You're muted, Chris.
Sorry. The biggest challenge that I found for the World Cup, and Johnny will probably face that as well, and he faces it every day, is communication in the Caribbean. It's very difficult to get a message out in unison across individual countries. It's so much easier, for instance, when South Africa hosts a Cricket World Cup. The CEO, if there's an issue, the CEO goes on SABC and the nation hears it. We have a very disparate broadcast structure, different media, every country has its own newspapers and so on. So the whole question of communication is always a challenge in the Caribbean. And so, you know, that is one thing that I'm sure Johnny will be looking at. And I can tell you the different interpretations Certainly one of the big mistakes we made in that communication was, for instance, using international nomenclature around the World Cup without fully understanding how it was going to be interpreted. So when we talk about a prohibited and restricted list, Johnny, you know, everybody in the Caribbean interpreted prohibited and restricted as the same meaning, whereas restricted might be the size of a container or cooler. It's not banned, it's not prohibited, and a gun might be prohibited. And so, but once you have a PNR list, because that was the nomenclature of the day, you know, every global event had a prohibited and restrictions list. Everybody just assumed everything on that list was prohibited, was banned. So it's understanding the communication, using the right words, and I think we've learned a lot for that. I do have a question for Johnny, though, in terms of a wider topic. And one, you know, I've seen now former test players talking about the challenges that test cricket faces. You know, to my mind, a much more commercially friendly, consumer-friendly version of the sport has come along that is now taking over. And so there are whole generations growing up on this T20 that have zero interest in test cricket, and therefore there has to be some concerns about the future of test cricket. I wanted to hear his views on that. Mm. But also, secondly, with cricket returning to the Olympics, it is an event where individually countries have participated for decades. Jamaica has an extremely proud history in the Olympic Games. In fact, we consider ourselves one of the big brands of the Olympic Games. And therefore, it might be the opportunity to get re-engaged the international, the national teams of these countries as international teams, and therefore re-engaging the national resources that are needed, which I think will be, to the long run, to the benefit of West Indies cricket. You have a Jamaica, a Barbados, compete. So Jamaica might play Barbados in a four-day championship at Sabina Park, Johnny. I don't think it's going to generate at a 1/100th of the interest of Jamaica playing Barbados at Sabina Park as an Olympic qualifier.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Chris, on that front. I think going back to Andrew's point, or Dr. Ford's, is the risks that we're worried about, the risks that we can't control. And yes, there will be all sorts of contingencies in place for an event of this size, and we will continue to put contingencies in place for all sorts of different scenarios that we will test. But you know, the risks of we know what happens or can happen in the region in June in terms of weather. No one can control that, and they're the kind of risks that we're always concerned about. We've just coming out of COVID is still a memory, hopefully a more becoming distant memory, and we certainly don't want pandemics or security threats or anything else. So those are the real risks that we can't control, that we would be concerned on. In terms of test cricket, Chris, I would say that, yeah, we've been very vocal at ICC. We wrote a strategic paper in 2018 around the threats of the T20 leagues and the need to regulate them and control them. We wrote an economics of cricket paper around sharing of bilateral cricket revenue, because we think the model is broken. We've come up with ideas around revenue sharing, test match windows, and we continue to lobby ICC and the full member boards on that. I still think test cricket has a role to play in the cricket ecosystem. I think it's still the ultimate test of a cricketer's skill, both mentally and physically and tactically, but that's not to say that T20 cricket is probably and arguably the most exciting sport in the world in terms of what it can potentially achieve in a short format version. But that doesn't necessarily have to be at the detriment of test cricket. We heard yesterday that Edgbaston has sold out for the first time ever the first 4 days of a test match, and that's it. That's involving the West Indies. And yes, you're right, Sabina Park for four-day cricket, or most places in the world for four-day cricket, isn't going to have many bums on seats. So that's not to say that people aren't interested in the results and the scorecards and the data. And similarly with Test cricket, it's obviously the longest format of the game, and certainly in terms of social media stats and the data and analytics, like, you know, it's in baseball, it has a very fanatical fan base, albeit an aging fan base, but people are living longer, and, you know, we shouldn't discount a market just because it aged over 40. But Test cricket has some work to do. I think all the formats have some work to do. I think not just Test cricket, bilateral cricket doesn't necessarily have a defined right to be at the top of the cricket economic tree. And if any administrators think that status quo will continue forever, then this wonderful game will probably prove them wrong. So I think we've got to be acutely aware of the changing forces, of the changing decisions that broadcasters are making around their how they value series, how they value cricket. And yes, there is a big move to short form cricket, not just T20 cricket, but as we've seen more recently, T10 cricket. And we cannot be ignorant to that, and we can't be blind to it or deaf to it. And we've got to continue to navigate. And we also should never be silent or mute around how we see the game in the West Indies. And we see those challenges. We've been aware of them for a while. And we certainly continue to lobby around the economic model of international cricket. We continue to lobby around a balance between the different formats of the game, creating context and giving fans what they want, which Test series in themselves should be an event. They need to have as much focus and space to breathe and to give the fans attention. None of us have. We're all busier, and there's more choice out there. And to have so much cricket happening all the time is, you know, there's only so much that certain fans, obviously the hardcore and dedicated, would always find time to watch. But, you know, we need to be respectful of that. And as I say, I think we've got a big job to do, starting at the top of the game in terms of how it's structured, but also here in the West Indies. And I agree with you, the Olympics opportunity is huge. We saw Barbados women take place in the Commonwealth Games. I think the whole sort of engagement around multi-sport games is something that we're taking very seriously. We've had dialogue, at least initially, with Pan Am Games in the Caribbean and Central American, or the Central Central America and Caribbean Games. And I think that T20 international status for some of our members is something that we're looking to see how we can achieve that. Because I take your point, I think state of origin, to use an Australian parlance, the state of origin cricket in T20 formats are not Talawas versus the Royals, but Barbados versus Jamaica in the example you've given, Chris, playing for T20 rankings, playing for potentially how you might qualify for an Olympic Games, a Pan Am Games or whatever, Commonwealth Games. I think that is exactly the way in which we will, as you say, ignite that that passion that people have around their, and rightly so, around their sovereign nations and their home identities and flags. But I certainly don't think that that is to the detriment of West Indies cricket, and I don't think that the Olympics per se has to be a threat to West Indies cricket. Neither do I think that T20 has to be a threat to the Test cricket. But if we don't make good decisions and smart decisions, it certainly has the potential. And that's something we've got to be cognizant of, but also guard against.
All right.
I'm certainly glad you're exploring it, Johnny. I'm certainly glad. The reaction that I get every time I talk about Jamaica or Barbados playing by themselves international T20 is, you know, you're trying to destroy West Indies cricket. But of course, it's not that. It's how it's the one part that I definitely think you'd find much more engagement is actually with the governments. You have some now, but believe me, I believe the kind of political goodwill, political largesse, and actually political money that you can get if your team playing international cricket is certainly would benefit West Indies cricket in the long run.
And if I might add, though, doubling down on what Chris is saying, now, as Cricket West Indies and as the ICC try to get cricket more into the Pan Am Games and have more discussion with the CSC, don't you think now that this would force Cricket West Indies and the CPL to have an even stronger discussion about having a parallel T20 tournament? Because most of these games don't allow for a West Indies team to be played, but more from a national team perspective. So coming back to Chris's point about having more international, more T20 cricket being played amongst between nations rather than
sorry, Andy's getting his saxophone out. I can't hear you.
Yeah. No, I think back to Chris's point, as I was mentioning, as Cricket West Indies and ICC tried to get cricket more into the Pan Am games and the CSC games, which means now that this is called for national teams, coming back to Chris's point about having a more government relation and government investment now into cricket. Because let's say for a small country like Jamaica, for many in the Caribbean, Jamaica pretty much represents a brand, our brand at the Olympic Games. So when you look at cricket now entering the Olympic Games and you want to be part of the Pan Am Games, does this force Cricket West Indies now and CPL to have that even more discussion now to have more T20 tournaments played amongst countries rather than franchise cricket?
Yeah, look, both Pete Russell, the CEO of the Caribbean Premier League, and myself have been on record saying that we are doing everything we can to bring around a second T20 tournament for 2025 as a legacy to this T20 event that would be played on a country basis rather than a franchise basis. It would be really about an eye on development, and certainly something that we definitely want to embrace, whether that involves the full sort of T20 international rankings at this stage. That's probably premature for me to say, but certainly those discussions are live. Mm-hmm. The CPL contract from year 10 onwards allowed us to have the Caribbean T20, as it was called back in the day, back on the roster of events, and certainly we're in advanced discussion internally about how that would look like, and certainly the intention is in 2025 for us to have a regional T20 tournament outside of the CPL that wouldn't involve overseas players, but as Chris rightly says, could be a fantastic event in its own right. If Andrew would stop mashing up his own show and playing his music, I'd be able to listen to your questions a bit more attentively.
Well, it's not me, actually. I think it's Yagoro there in Borough County. We've been trying to reach him. Hello, Yago, how are you?
Hey, how you guys doing, man? Yes.
Okay, good, wonderful.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Right. Well, there's a gentleman called Chris Darren, who, of course, is Jamaican like yourself, and I'm sure he would want to say hello to you. Yagoro's on the line, Chris.
And a batting stylist like himself.
Yes. Yes. How are you, sir? How are you doing?
It's like I recognized the voice when I was listening, and I said, that is Chris. It sounds like Chris.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I'm doing well, thanks.
Right.
I have to thank the Lord, man. I'm doing well. Turned 75 yesterday.
Yes. You turned 75. Yes. So belated happy birthday greetings to you. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, man, thanks. We're going to celebrate it on the 19th.
Right. Okay. Wonderful. So, what's happening to you? I mean, there's going to be a big celebration up in your part of the world. That magnificent 300 that you made, that triple century. Tell us about it.
Yes. The triple 100 is four of us who have done it. Sir Gary was the number one man, and then I came in number two, and then Brian and Chris came along, and they were very greedy. They got two each.
I see.
So it's 50 years now. This year will be 50. I think it's in March or something. That's about 50 years since I made the transition too. So the foundation decided this year that they're on me. I'm getting on there, so they're on me. So we invited a few of the former legends that I played with, and we tried to get some of the younger ones to come along. We tried to get Brian to come. Mm-hmm. At the 300 club, but he's going to be on duties in Australia with the West Indies team. Chris is the one that we are, about 75% chance that he would be here. I had spoken to him, and he was supposed to get back to me, but we haven't connected yet. So hopefully he'll be here. So it's like a celebrity-type weekend because we just got you and Blake to join us.
Oh, Johan Blake. Oh, yes.
He's going to join because we have a celebrity cricket match.
Oh, yes.
So he's going to join us. And we have an NFL star, who the former running back for the Atlanta Falcons, Devante Freeman. He'll be joining us as well in the event. So we have some other sports people apart from cricketers participating in the activities over the weekend. On Friday evening when the guys come in, we have Sir Vivian who's coming over and Sir Handy.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, Joel Garner is coming over and Carlos King is coming over, you know, to join us. And Courtney Walsh should be here as well.
So
we have quite a few of those. Ronnie Starwan and Paul Backus, you know, and Alvin Kalichara. Those are the guys who more or less would be joining us over the weekend. It should be fabulous. You know, they're going to celebrate that tournament too. I need somebody from Barbados to tell a little bit of the stories about the things that I've heard over the years.
Tremendous. You know, 50 years ago. Tremendous, yes.
I'm going to put pressure on Chris right now because I sent him a text and I asked him a question so I can ask him on here to let him decline our... I need him to be my keynote speaker.
Oh, really? Chris, keynote speaker, you heard it first on Mason and Guess.
That was, you really must be desperate, y'all.
Tell me, you can't tell me no. So, you know, especially when I announce it on the show, you can't tell me no.
only if I'm allowed to tell the world how you brought me into the world of cricket.
Oh, my golly. Tell us about it, Chris.
Oh, that's a fact. It's a fact.
Mm.
I was a little boy playing on the steps of Kingston Cricket Club. And a man named Lawrence Rowe made his test debut.
Mm-hmm.
And in warming up, remember the players used to stay in Kingston Cricket Club. I had no interest in the game. I was like 10 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Very little interest. This man was warming up before the game and he hit a ball over the low fence at Kingston Cricket Club.
Yes.
Mash up machine.
Mm.
But he kept coming to check on me and he had me actually sit with the players.
Oh, wonderful.
Sit right beside the players. And he would come to check on my shin. And that was Lawrence Rowe and he made 214 and 100 not out. And I followed him ever since. I became a Yaga fanatic.
Oh, my God.
But so when I played cricket,
right,
if you ask Basil Williams, any other Kensington guys, they used to joke about me that I was Yaga because I walked like him, talked like him, tried to whistle when I batted like
My golly. Oh, my golly. Yes, wonderful. Well, but based on all that, I'm sure that Chris will accept the invitation to be the keynote speaker, Yaga. He's going to come, no doubt about that.
Yes, he told me he's going to be here.
I've been there for sure.
Wonderful. So what we will do, Yaga, we'll continue this discussion next week because I also want to get into the whole question of the World Cup. As you know, there are going to be some matches in your part of the world, and I'm sure you're looking forward to that.
Yes. So my little event here is the precursor to that as well.
Exactly.
It is published like that, you know. It is published like that.
Wonderful.
So we hope to bring out the community up here, you know.
Wonderful. So we'll certainly be in contact with you again next week because we want to go down memory lane with you as well because, you know, you've got a huge fan base in Barbados. Yaga, I wish you all the success in that tremendous event.
Oh, yeah. No problem at all. So we'll come on next week and we'll tell Barbados a little bit more about it.
All right. Well, I want you to come on Zoom because I'm sure that they want to hear from you. I want to thank Chris Darren for coming on the show. Thanks to my very good friend, Johnny Grave. You always come on the show despite the fact that we give you several punches. Thank you very much, Raul Tony. Thanks to you, Dr. Ford. And I would want to say to you, Johnny, that I've got a clip. I'll certainly send it to you. I'm Andrew Mason. Here's soap in for a bye tomorrow. It's good night.